Well, after tackling Vince Lombardi and President Clinton and Al Gore and Roberto Clemente, David Marinese has captured the 18 days of 1960 that made up the Summer Olympics in Rome. And I'm really pleased to have him with us today. There's a new book just out. It's called Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World. I've had a chance to read it. I was fascinated by it, and I think you'll be fascinated in the story that he has to tell as well as we visit about history and politics and sports and how they all came together in Rome in 1960. David Marinese, my guest, and if you'd like to join in with questions or comments as we move along today, I hope you will. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. David, welcome back.
Nice. Hey, thanks, Larry. Great to be with you again.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. I loved your book. I really enjoyed it. I'm old enough to have watched some of the Olympics, and as I looked at some of the photos, I kind of recognized at least the marching in.
Yes,
that part, the costumes or what the guys from the U.S. were wearing.
Well, I was 11 years old in 1960, and since those were the first televised games, they're etched pretty deeply in my memory too.
Yeah, it was. Why did and I think I know why, but let's talk.
Sure.
Why would you select? Why did you select the Olympics, the 1960 Olympics?
Well, they came to me against my will, to a certain extent, to tell you the true story. My last book was about Roberto Clemente.
Mm-hmm.
His first great season was 1960, when the Pirates, his team, won the pennant in the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was researching that book in that year, looking through old sports sections, I kept coming across these magical names, Wilma Rudolph, Cassius Clay, Rafer Johnson, Abibi Bikila. And I kept saying to myself, no, I don't want to do another sports book right now. But I couldn't get those names out of my head. And so I started looking into it a little more deeply. And when I saw that I could use those events and those characters to really write a history book through the drama of sports and tell the story of the modern world coming into view at that moment, then I just went into it full bore.
And it's a fascinating story. You must have, the detail that you have, the interesting detail is just it's wonderful. How did you do it?
Well,
did you go to Rome?
Went
to Rome.
Yeah. The story I like to say is, it was a lot easier to persuade my wife to go to Rome than to move to Green Bay for the winter to do the Lombardi book. So in a sense, this was a payoff. But yes, my first motto is go there. So we went to Rome for several weeks, retraced all of the roots of the Olympics, and got a lot of good material from the Italian Olympic Committee, interviewed Italian athletes and sports writers, went to Lausanne, Switzerland, where the International Olympic Committee archive is a very rich archive, did work in archives all over the world, really, including Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, where the Avery Brundage archive is. He was the crusty old president of the IOC. A lot of the political documents came from the National Archives in Washington. And then I had the joy of interviewing a lot of the athletes.
Yeah, it's wonderful that so many of them are still here to be interviewed. Obviously, there are quite a few have passed, but
yes,
but many are here. Well, take us back to that time again. It was, you know, politically and so forth. The
yes.
climate was quite a bit.
Oh, it was. The summer of 1960 was a very tense time in the world and in the United States. In the world, the Cold War was never hotter.
Yeah.
Right before the Olympics began, the trial of Gary Powers, the spy plane, U-2 reconnaissance mm-hmm. plane pilot who had been shot down over the Soviet Union airspace, that trial ended with his conviction, although they later made a swap to get him out of the Soviet Union. And before the Olympics ended, Nikita Khrushchev, the premier of Russia, set sail from the Baltic to New York to appear before the United Nations, where he made his famous fist-pounding speech railing against the West. So it was a very tense time. In the United States, the tension had to do with race relations. This was an early moment in the civil rights movement, the summer of a lot of sit-ins around the country at lunch counters. And so that was the dominant, and plus it was also the political campaigns of Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy. So a very rich milieu right at that moment.
Yeah. And in terms of the politics, the racial issue was something that the communist countries, for example, were trying to use against the United States.
You know, it's an obvious point in retrospect, but as I was researching the book, I was really struck by the role that the civil rights issue in the U.S. played in the world, and really how the fact that the United States had a hard time proclaiming itself as the beacon of freedom around the world when so many of its people in the United States, including its great Olympic athletes, were denied civil rights. And so a lot of pressure was put on by the State Department and the Eisenhower administration and then the Kennedy administration to resolve the civil rights issue, not just because of the equality of it and the morality of it, but because of its effect in foreign affairs and the way the Soviet Union kept pounding away at it. Now, in 1960, that was particularly crucial because Black Africa was gaining its independence that summer. 14 nations were getting off the yoke of colonialism. And so it was a fertile territory in the Cold War fight between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And here the U.S. had this civil rights, Jim Crow segregation burden to carry in that fight.
And we had, at the same time, many of our best athletes were Black athletes,
well,
Rafer Johnson,
yes,
and so forth. Wilmer Rudolph.
The triumvirate, there were many, many great athletes from the U.S. and around the world, but the three most famous from the U.S. were Wilmer Rudolph, the terrific, beautiful sprinter from Little Tennessee State University in Nashville, Tennessee, who swept all the sprints, and the Tiger Bells, her team from Tennessee State, won the relay race. You know, an incredible story in and of itself. Wilma overcame childhood polio. The Tiger Bells had to overcome all of the troubles of being both women and Black in that era, where they didn't have any scholarships. They didn't even have an office for their coach. Just overcame everything to be triumphant. Rafer Johnson, who was the first Black to carry the American flag and the greatest athlete of that era, the decathlete champion. And then, of course, the 18-year-old light heavyweight from Louisville, Cassius Clay, who was not yet Muhammad Ali, but had the same personality at age 18.
Yeah, he really displayed that personality. You know, the one of the intriguing things, and I'd kind of forgotten about it, in this day and age where women athletes are so prominent, and, you know, we kind of forget about back in the at that time, the 1960s, Ed Temple, the coach at Tennessee State University, I mean, he had nothing, really.
He had absolutely nothing. Well, there were no women's NCAA programs. This was a decade before Title IX. And, in fact, Title IX and all the women athletes to follow owe a lot to Ed Temple and to Wilma Rudolph and the Tiger Bells for what they did in 1960. But, yes, He had a monthly salary of $1,000. He had no scholarships. He had no office. He had to share his office with his wife, who was the postmistress of the college. They didn't have a bus to take their team around. They traveled in station wagons, packing peanut butter and jelly sandwiches on their way to Tuskegee or Alabama State. Really, absolutely coming out of nowhere to develop the greatest women's track and field program in American history.
Yeah, it was a wonderful program. And I love the story that you tell in it about how Ed Temple got to go to the
Well, that was how he got to go to the – that was 2 years earlier, 1958.
Yeah, 2 years earlier, that's right.
That's where the book starts, 1958. Yeah. The U.S. and the Soviet Union had their first dual meet in track and field, a very important event in terms of the propaganda part of the Cold War. And – Ed Temple took his Tiger Bells up to New Jersey for the trials, and he had no clue whether he would be the coach or not. But before the establishment of track and field met to decide who would be the women's coach, Temple told someone, "Look, I came up here on a lad chartered bus with the winners of the 100-yard meter dash, the 200-meter dash, the relays, the long jump, and we're all going back on that charter bus Monday morning unless I'm their coach." And so they came out and said, "Ed Temple, you're the coach."
Oh, man. David Marinas, our guest today, associate editor of The Washington Post, author of the book Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World, is published by Simon & Schuster. As I mentioned, many previous books, including When Pride Still Mattered, A Life of Vince Lombardi, and First in His Class, A Biography of Bill Clinton. As we visit today with him about his book, give us a call if you have a question or comment as we move along here. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Here we are in the heat of the Cold War, and we've got the place was teeming with spies and reports of defections or potential defections.
Oh yeah, it was quite an interesting atmosphere in Rome. And among the many things that were going on was that there was a Soviet athlete, Igor Tarovanessian, who I interviewed for the book, who was a long jumper, and he was very westernized. And The American intelligence agencies had the idea that he could probably be turned and defect during the Olympics. So they recruited an American athlete, David Sim, who was a medical student at Duke University, very smart guy, a sprinter, and someone that they'd worked with before because he'd gone on a State Department tour of Burma and the Far East. And they, before the Olympics, they recruited Sim and said, how would you like to help us with Tarovanessian when you get to Rome? And so Sim agreed. He was, you know, a patriot and wanted to help. And he met Tarovanessian several times in Rome, took him out for dinner. Everything was set up. There was a CIA agent who went by the name of Mr. Wolf, located in Rome, who was fluent in Russian and was supposed to close the deal. And the way Sim tells the story, and Tarovanessian seconds it, and both of my interviews with them, they were at dinner, and Mr. Wolf appears, and he starts talking to Tarovanessian in the Armenian dialect of Russian, and it scared the heck out of Tarovanessian. He thought this guy must be a double agent of some sort. And so he stood up and said, Mr. Sim, I trust you, I don't, and he walked out, and the CIA blew the whole thing.
Oh, that's a great story. One of many great stories in the book that David has written. And I'll tell you what, we're approaching here a little break in the news, and we'll take that break, and we'll get back, and we got lots more to cover here. I certainly want to ask more about Rafer Johnson and Wilma Rudolph and Cassius Clay and John Thomas, maybe. There's so many great stories in this book, and we'll get to that here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with David Marinas of Madison, associate editor of The Washington Post, author of several wonderful books, including the one we're visiting with him today about. It's called Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Really pleased to have him with us today. You have you've got history, you've got politics, you've got sports, all intertwined in this book, and as well some great insights into the individuals, people like Cassius Clay and Wilma Rudolph that participated in those Olympics, and against a really interesting backdrop. You have some questions or comments, or maybe you've got a remembrance or two. I really want to talk about Jim McKay and some of the television reporting of it as well. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We'll be back with David right after the news. Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're talking now with David Marinas, associate editor of the Washington Post, author of several books, including the one we're discussing today. It's titled, and just out, Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World, when history and politics and sports all combined into this book. Really pleased to have him with us today, and certainly inviting your questions and comments as we move along in discussing it. If you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Anywhere else, toll-free at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and with your comments. And, David, the whole race issue, I think it was important, or at least the politicians thought it was important, that Rafer Johnson, for example, lead the Olympic the Olympic team. And
well, yes, Rafer deserved to carry the flag for the U.S. He was the greatest athlete. He was also a young man of great integrity,
yes.
A graduate of UCLA, and so he deserved it in every respect. But it also had a political component to it. As we were talking about earlier, with the United States in an embarrassing position around the world because of the segregation at home, it was important to make a statement about the team, and Rafer Johnson walking in at the front of the delegation as the captain of the U.S. squad was that statement.
Yeah, and I think he would have been elected by his teammates anyway.
Oh, he would have been. But, you know, he had mixed feelings about it. He knew to a certain extent that he was being used.
Yeah.
This is 8 years before Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists and the Black Power salute in Mexico City. And a lot happened in those 8 years. This is sort of the beginning of that whole thing. And Rafer Johnson was not blind to all of the hypocrisy involved in these things. He was also upset that the Olympic officials had said he couldn't perform in a movie, Spartacus, where he was offered a small role because they said it would have broken his amateur status. So he went to Rome with a certain amount of anger and a sophisticated understanding of what was going on. But he believed deeply that the strongest statement he could make as a black man in the U.S. in 1960 was to be the best athlete he could be and carry himself with dignity.
And as you mentioned, things are quite a bit different now in terms of amateurism. There was another guy, and I'm trying to remember now, who he and his wife were in some dance or something, and
there were all kinds of things were going on. It was two of the gymnasts who were would have been disqualified just for participating in a summer camp program. what you're thinking of, I think, is Lee Calhoun, the great sprint hurdler.
Hurdler, yes.
Who was suspended for an entire year because he and his wife, Gwen, took part in the show Bride and Groom.
That's right.
And they got so as part of that show, you get some presents for, you know, wedding presents. The AAU said that was entirely because he was a well-known hurdler. And that because they took the presents, he was disqualified, suspended for an entire year. Just preposterous.
Jim in Wausau has a question or comment. Jim, hello.
Hi.
Thanks.
I hope the presents were good presents anyway.
Yeah.
Well, included a honeymoon to Paris.
Ah, okay. Well, that might be worth missing a year. Talk a little bit. This is off topic. It has nothing to do with race relations. But talk a little bit about a BB tequila, if you don't mind.
Oh, it isn't off topic, and it does have to do with race relations.
Yeah.
BB Bekele is an entire chapter in my book.
Yes.
He was the Ethiopian marathoner. He came to Rome utterly unknown, and he won the marathon running barefoot through the streets of the capital city of a nation that had conquered his Ethiopia in 1935 and 6. And in the beauty of that moment, he actually ran past on his way out and back in the marathon the Aksum Obelisk, a very historic monument that was taken from Aksum, Ethiopia, by Mussolini and his army and put into Rome. So he actually started his sprint toward victory after he passed the Aksum Obelisk. But he was just a wonderful story. He was a skinny little guy running barefooted along the Appian Way, the uneven cobblestones, coming out of nowhere to capture the gold medal. He was in the Imperial Guard of Haile Selassie, the Emperor of Ethiopia. And when he got back, of course, he was promoted several times. He won again in 1964 in Tokyo, the greatest marathoner in history in most respects, and then got in a traffic accident and died tragically at an early age.
Yeah.
I remember, I can't remember which Olympics it was, but it was after the accident, before he died. They showed him sitting trackside, you know, with a blanket over his lap, and it looked, you know, it wasn't a very nice picture. Is it true that in 64 they required everybody to wear shoes, so he ran the first couple hundred yards and kicked his shoes off and then completed the race?
No, he ran the 64 race. I mean, I'm not a specialist on 64, but from all of the research I did, he ran the entire 64 race in shoes. There was he didn't run in barefooted in 60 because he wanted to run barefoot. He ran because the new shoes that he had were uncomfortable and giving him blisters. And he'd run barefoot many times in Ethiopia. So while all the other marathoners were moaning about the difficulties of running on the Appian Way, to Bakila, who'd run on rocks and over mountains for years, it was no big deal.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Jim.
Right. Yep.
Appreciate the call. You can join us, too, at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. I do want to get to some television coverage. There's lots we can talk about here. But Jim McKay, that was his first Olympics.
Yes.
It was actually the first televised.
It was the first televised Summer Olympics. The Squaw Valley was televised that winter before it. Yes, and Jim McKay was plucked from a show called The Verdict Is Yours. He wasn't even a sports specialist yet. This was a sort of a courtroom drama, and made the studio host for the Rome Olympics for CBS. And he didn't even go to Rome. He stayed in a studio in New York City. This was before the era of satellites, so there was no live coverage of the Rome events. CBS sent a unit of less than 50 producers and technicians and a total of 3 announcers to Rome, compared with the 4,000 that NBC is sending to Beijing. The video and film would be put in canisters onto commercial jets and flown from Rome to Idlewild Airport in New York, where they would rush it over to Grand Central Station and try to get it on the air perhaps that night because of the six-hour time difference, but more often the next day. Jim McKay said that he would literally take the film canisters and sometimes put them under his armpit to warm them up because they'd been in the belly of the commercial jet and were cold. He would type out his scripts on a portable typewriter in the editing room while the film was being edited, and sometimes look up something about a country in the Encyclopedia Britannica. You know, it was that basic, and that's where all of what would come later began. And of course, his performance for the Rome Olympics was watched by an ABC producer named Rune Arledge, and it was after that Arledge persuaded him to be the first host of Wide World of Sports, and then many Olympics for ABC thereafter.
I'm sorry at his passing, because he was a great guy, I think. Did you had a chance to visit?
I did interview him, yes. And, you know, I think he was sort of like a well-intentioned, face value, intelligent uncle for a lot of us who watched him on the Olympics.
Yeah, I would agree. Well, let's talk about Cassius Clay a little bit.
Yeah. Cassius Clay, first of all, getting him over to Rome was not easy because he hated to fly. He said if God wanted us to fly, he'd give us wings. And so, you know, the coach actually gave him some kind of a sleeping pill on the flight over, but it didn't work on Cassius. And he blabbed all the way across the Atlantic, boasting about how he was going to win a gold medal and then become the heavyweight champion of the world. He was already into his I am the greatest mode. He was only 18 years old. A light heavyweight from Louisville, Kentucky. When he got to Rome, he saw his first bidet and thought it was a water fountain, according to his boxing mates. And he had the exact same personality that he would have for the rest of his life, but he didn't have the meaning behind it. So he was kind of like the Clown Prince. I don't make him one of the most important characters in the book, because that's not what he was, but he definitely was entertaining. And after he won his gold medal against a big old left-handed Polish guy, and by the way, for the Wisconsin audience, they'd be interested to, some of them might already know that Cassius Clay had lost an amateur bout trying out for the Pan American Games in Madison, Wisconsin, in the field house a year earlier. and he lost to a big old Marine who was also left-handed. So when he got to Rome and up against the left-handed pole, he'd done that before, and it helped him in that bout to win the gold medal. After he won the gold medal, he would never take it off. He slept in it. He walked around the Olympic Village with it. With it the next day, and one of the Tiger Bells, one of Wilma Rudolph's running mates, saw Cassius, who was head over heels for Wilma Rudolph,
right,
as was everybody, and said, "Cassius, go sit down somewhere." he was so boastful about what he'd done that nobody else could stand it.
And I think a lot of people were in love with Wilma Rudolph.
Yes. Everybody I interviewed. Every male that I interviewed. And she was such a sweet person that none of the women were jealous of her either. But, yeah, I interviewed Livio Baruti, the great Italian stallion who won the 200-meter dash from Italy. He said that he loved Wilma and they had a platonic relationship that he wanted to change. Cassius was in love with her. Ray Norton, one of the sprinters, actually was Wilma's boyfriend during the Olympics. But she had just a magnetic appeal. I mean, the whole entire World Press Corps fell in love with her, too. They called her La Gazelle Negra, the Black Gazelle. And the French sports writers, the Italian sports writers, the Brits, the whole world was just mad for Wilma Rudolph.
And she was a very articulate person.
She was a very smart young woman who had overcome so much, both a teenage pregnancy and childhood polio. And the great ending to the Wilma, I mean, her final ending is tragic. She died at a too early age of brain cancer. But after she returned from Rome, her hometown of Clarksville, Tennessee, wanted to hold a parade and banquet for her. And she said very strongly, in 1960, I'll only do it if you integrate the banquet. And so this very segregated Tennessee town, because of Wilma Rudolph, held a banquet where Blacks and whites sat next to each other and ate together for the first time in that kind of setting.
Yeah. And her death was sad. Near the end of the book, you has very touching comments with about Ed Temple and her and their last
meeting. Yeah, Ed Temple, it was 1992, and she was dying of cancer, and they spent a last day walking around the track at the old Tennessee State track, talking about everything they'd accomplished over the decades, and then they went to a barbecue, Sweat's Barbecue in North Nashville, and had a final lunch. And she died a few days later.
And what was her? She was it cancer? I forgot.
It was brain cancer.
Yeah, brain cancer. Yeah. Very, very sad. Well, Rayford Johnson certainly is. You highlight him in your book quite a bit, and his whole competition, and talk some more about Rayford Johnson.
Rayford Johnson grew up in a small town in the valley of California, a Swedish town, Kingsburg. His was the only black family in town. His hero as a high school kid was Bob Mathias, the great decathlete from that part of California. So he decided he would be a decathlete. Rafer was great at everything. He played basketball for John Wooden at UCLA. He played football. His brother Jimmy Johnson was a Hall of Fame football player for the San Francisco 49ers. Just terrific athletes. But Rafer devoted himself to the decathlon. He had competed in 1956 in Melbourne at those Olympics, but he was injured and finished second and devastated by that. In 1958, he went to Moscow for that first dual track meet with the Soviets, and he was battling against Vasily Kuznetsov, the great Soviet decathlete. And Rafer was so great that at the end of the two-day competition, the Russian crowd carried him off the field on their shoulders. And so he came to Rome really as the best-known athlete in the world, because track and field is much more popular in the rest of the world than it is in the United States. His competition in Rome included Kuznetsov, but even tougher was a Taiwanese decathlete named C.K. Young, who was also his classmate. I mean, he was also at UCLA. So they were really good friends. And Young was terrific. And it came down to the final event, the metric mile, the 1,500 meters. Young was better at that event. All he had to do was beat Rafer by 10 seconds, and he would win the gold medal. But Rafer knew that this was his last time ever competing in the decathlon. He knew what he had to do. He gutted it up and stuck at CK's shoulder the entire race. CK said he turned around once and saw that Rafer was smiling back at him. And Rafer said he didn't feel like smiling, but he knew he had to do it. And he stayed in there the entire race, a thrilling finish. And Rafer Johnson won the gold medal, and they collapsed in each other's arms, sort of a really nice statement of their friendship and brotherhood.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, on the other end of things, one thing we haven't – I mentioned that there was the first doping scandal.
Yes.
And that involved a Danish cyclist.
Knud Enemark Jensen. The Danes several of the Danes had taken a doping that affected their blood. And it was the first day of competition and the road race, and Jensen collapsed and died. And at first they said it was heat stroke, but then the next day a Danish trainer had said he'd administered this drug to all of the Danes. And there was still some controversy about why he died, but it had the profound effect of changing everything. The World Doping Agency was formed eventually because of that single death. All of the dope testing in the Olympics and many other sports began with that single moment where the Danish cyclist died. Also in Rome, although it wasn't known at the time, the Soviet and some of the American weightlifters were experimenting with anabolic steroids. They had no idea what effect it was having, but that was the beginning of that.
Tobias in Stevens Point, we'll give you a chance. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I had a question about the economic implications of the Rome Olympics, simply because nowadays, if you think about Olympic Games, there's obviously the sports spectacle, but for the host country, it has huge implications in terms of tourism and so forth. And I was just wondering if you could say something about how the Rome Olympics were an important factor both for Italy and maybe also on a global level.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was the beginning of that whole way of looking at the Olympics as more than just sports, but as an economic boom. The Italians funded the Olympics with a lottery, and they didn't make too much money off the Olympics. And certainly the IOC did not, compared with later decades when they could make multi millions, if not billions, from it. Consumerism was just beginning, the whole notion of sponsorships for Olympics. In Rome, Coca-Cola was a big sponsor. That was just starting. The shoe companies were getting into it. That's another angle to it, not quite what you're asking. But Adidas and Puma, the German shoe companies, were illegally paying Armin Hari, one of the great sprinters from Germany, to wear their shoes. That was just starting. For Italy, more than the economics of it, also the Olympic Village became public housing for poorer people in Rome after the Olympics. There was a lot of corruption, but the main effect was that it was sort of Italy's reintroduction into the modern world 15 years after it was a part of the Axis powers, in World War II. And so it had a very important psychological effect on Italy. And all of the Italians that I interviewed, the sports writers, the athletes, all talked about it as sort of a moment when they came out of the shadows and into the sunshine of the modern world.
Interesting. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call very much. You mentioned the IOC and the billions or millions that they make now, but when Avery Brundage, who is a real character, they were kind of hat in hand to get money from to cover.
Yeah, they were kind of like the rich inheritors who are living in a mansion but don't have any money because the IOC was essentially a monarchist establishment. Group of including the Marquess of Exeter from Great Britain and various counts from Italy and Luxembourg. And, it was really an old men club, white old men's club. But they really didn't have much money. They operated out of Lausanne, Switzerland on pretty threadbare conditions until television. And this was the onset of television. And then every 4 years thereafter, television brought in more and more money until it became a gold mine.
Yeah, and he was talk just a little bit about him, because Avery Brundage was a real...
Yeah, he was an incredible contradictory character with sort of a certain idealism, but a lot of hypocrisy to him as well. He had been the chairman of the American Olympic Committee in 1936 when they went to Berlin to compete at the Nazi Olympics. A lot of Jewish groups in the United States wanted the U.S. to boycott Hitler's Germany. Brundage not only opposed that boycott, but wrote many letters that I found to his German associates denouncing the Jewish cabal in the United States. He was a complete anti-Semite. When he wrote later about the Berlin Olympics, he mentioned Jesse Owens, the great sprinter and long jumper, briefly, and wrote much longer about a fancy party he'd gone to at Heinrich Himmler's house in Berlin. Mm-hmm. I mean, so he was, and he came back and gave a big speech at the Madison Square Garden of the American-German Bund Society, praising Hitler and what the Germans had done with the Nazis, and saying that the U.S. could learn some things from them, which I guess is what Patrick Buchanan would say now, too.
I was just going to say, yeah, that's a complete aside, and one that anyway. We won't go into here. But you've written a fascinating story. I really want to thank you so much for being with us today to talk about it, David. It's a wonderful story, and I hope lots of people read it.
Well, that's great, and I'm going to be at Barnes and Noble next Tuesday night
in Madison.
Madison, yes, that's the start of my book tour, and then I'll be back in August again. But I'm traveling around the country all of July.
Thanks very much for being
here. Thank you, Larry.
David Marinesse, author of Rome, 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I really enjoyed reading the book, and I think you will, too. Thanks very much to David. Tomorrow, just to let you know, Garden Talk, UW-Madison, we got our fruit team of professors, Terrell Roper and Patty McManus, will be along to talk all things relating to fruits here in Wisconsin. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.